It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host, Mark Young. What's the topic for today, Mark?
Well, Chuck, we're going to talk about CRISPR. We're going to talk about gene editing, and we're going to talk about all kinds of fun things in science. So, folks, you're not going to want to miss this.
So it's a cooking show.
It's a cooking show, yes.
Okay, I got you.
Now, you said, what was that movie? It's a cookbook.
Yes.
We're having a guard against
where the aliens came in. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. The invasion of the body snatchers. Right.
Well, it was another movie, but that's okay. It was actually wasn't a movie. It was a TV series.
Oh, whatever. So, interesting thing happened, Chuck. The president signed a bill making it a felony to be cruel to animals.
Yep.
I think this seems nice, including it means you can't torture them, impale them, or crush them, which just sounds disgusting.
It does.
But what's interesting about...
You know, I'll tell you something. I saw something, just to divert for a minute, on... what do they call when they take these pit bulls and dog fights?
Oh, the dog fights, yeah.
God, it was
terrible,
horrible.
Isn't it?
Oh, I mean, it was beyond anything I expected. If they didn't win a fight, this guy who was a quarterback for the NFL at one time,
Michael Vick,
they would hang them from a piece of wood and shoot them or torture them. I mean, it was beyond the pale of anything human. I just couldn't believe it. I was shocked.
President Trump has now made this behavior illegal. What I think is interesting is we're having some people on the left that are coming out saying that the bill doesn't go far enough.
Well, now it probably has to do with eating beef and eating pork and eating chickens and eating fish. And
well, this gets better.
Oh.
Claiming that he doesn't own a dog. And if he doesn't own a dog, then he's not serious about it.
Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. I've gone through periods of time where I didn't own a dog. Now I have three of them.
Now, what I think is really interesting is this bill actually sat on President Obama's desk at one point, or almost made it to President Obama's desk. It didn't make it to his desk. I don't want to blame President Obama for this.
Did it get stuck down the hall or something, or what? I mean, how does
it got stopped in the Senate by Harry Reid?
Was Harry Reid a famous dog crusher or what?
Well, Harry Reid's the guy that likes to kick his own ass on his treadmill, remember?
Oh, eloquently put.
He did, though. How many people do you know have kicked their own ass on a treadmill on New Year's Day?
I know. We all have our shortcomings.
I mean, the whole concept of that. Back to Harry Reid just for a second. How many people go to Las Vegas?
Mm-hmm.
And at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, you get up on New Year's Day and you go run on a treadmill. Because that's what everybody does after being up on New Year's Eve, right?
Well, who knows?
Maybe Harry Reid did party all night, was still drunk when he got on the treadmill.
You know, the great thing about it, I'll tell you what the great thing about this is. Harry Reid's gone.
Not there
He's
anymore.
No more a factor in anything. So
I know, but the fact
on.
That he kicked his own ass was just something I really enjoyed.
It was funny back then.
It was, and it has never stopped being funny. So anyways, one other thing, Chuck. I find this interesting that Maxine Waters, who's often known for her intellectual prowess, claims that Dr. Ben Carson, the brain surgeon who has managed to separate conjoined twins at the brain, doesn't have the intelligence to run HUD.
Well, you know, he has been under attack by the left forever for one reason or another. You can't make sense of it because he's obviously a brilliant surgeon and a brilliant person who's literally lifted himself up by his own bootstraps, so to speak. And you just can't give him any credit for anything he accomplishes. I mean, it's insane.
And this is the part I don't get. If you want to challenge Dr. Carson's political views...
Fine.
Challenge his political views,
but not
Dr. Carson to say that Dr. Carson isn't intelligent enough.
It's ridiculous
to run HUD, and you're Maxine Waters.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even put a sentence together.
I don't know. You know, you don't give Maxine credit where she deserves it. She's managed somehow to acquire an enormous amount of money while she's been in Congress.
And she doesn't even live in her own district.
I know. You got to have some kind of brains to pull that off.
I suppose. Well, we're going to talk to a guy today who's got a really big Dr. Carson kind of brain.
Yeah.
And he is also a doctor. This is Kiran Musunuru. He is an MD, a PhD. He's got so many letters after his name. It's crazy. He's a Harvard man. Also has done some extensive work with CRISPR.
I have no idea. When you say CRISPR, it sounds like chicken. What are you talking about? What's CRISPR?
Well, no, that's the kernel. That's extra crispy. We're not
That's crispy. What I mean. I have no clue what CRISPR is.
Well, I'm going to ask Dr. Musunuru to explain to Chuck Woolery what CRISPR is.
Thank you.
I could do it for you, but he can do it much better.
And the rest of the audience.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for having me on. And it's funny. Let me just take an aside. When I was at Johns Hopkins, I was training there as a cardiologist. I did actually work with Dr. Carson a little bit, found him to be a very genial and intelligent surgeon.
Oh, he's a nice man.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
He really is a very kind person, too.
Absolutely.
On top of being highly intelligent.
So with respect to CRISPR, is a type of gene editing tool. And so that takes us to what is gene editing. So gene editing is a technology that allows us to make changes to genes in the DNA, in the cells, in the body. And typically we're talking about genes that are related to health. So CRISPR is a type of gene editing tool. So gene editing is a technology that allows us to make changes to genes in the DNA, in cells, in the body. Now, typically these are genes that are related to health and disease. Now, it turns out there are several types of gene editing tools, but by far the most popular one is CRISPR. That's because it's the easiest to use and it works quite well compared to some of the other tools. You can
use CRISPR. Is this like a surgery or something, CRISPR?
You can think of it as genetic surgery. Yeah, so not like a physical surgery, but more like a genetic surgery where you're actually making changes in genes. And so you can use CRISPR.
Kiran, let me jump in for a second for Chuck. Sure. Chuck, you know how you've seen like somebody working on a website and you see all the programming that's on the screen, all the ones and zeros and all that programming, okay? Our genes are basically a program just like a computer program. So what CRISPR does, think about this, you have 3.4 billion genes on each side?
Yeah, so if you add up the number of letters in the entire genome, the whole collection of genes and all the DNA in each cell in the body, it's about 6.4 billion letters.
Okay.
Holy cow.
Right. So now, Chuck, imagine that you could go in and change the program. But, so you're looking at all these letters and words and you say, hey, I want to change this letter. Mm-hmm. That's what CRISPR lets you go do.
Okay.
Yeah, let me put it another way. So I think that's a good analogy, but another way to put it is consider the entire genome, the collection of all the DNA in every cell in your body. Think of that as a big book. And the DNA is distributed across what are known as chromosomes, and we each have 46 chromosomes in each of their cells. And so those are like the chapters of the book. And then each gene is like a paragraph in each chapter in each book. And each paragraph has a particular meaning and contributes to the overall story. And that's, in our case, the story of our health. And if things don't go quite right, the story of disease. What CRISPR allows you to do is make changes in those particular paragraphs, in sentences, in words, maybe even in letters. So what it can do very well is it can obscure the meaning of the paragraph. It can turn off genes. You can also make precise changes, although that's harder to do. You can actually go in and switch certain letters to others. So you can imagine if there's a typo in a gene that causes a disease, you can potentially use CRISPR to correct that typo.
So and then you wouldn't have that disease, or you wouldn't be prone to it, or what? It would cure it? What?
Potentially. So
it would do all of those things.
Potentially. So just very recently, last week, in fact, there was big news, at least in the biomedical world, that two patients who received CRISPR therapy earlier this year, these two patients had blood disorders. One had sickle cell disease. Another one had beta thalassemia, both terrible disorders with a lot of suffering. These two patients received CRISPR therapy earlier this year, and it looks like they may actually be cured, which is amazing because these diseases until now have been incurable. and affect tens of thousands of people in the United States and many more around the world.
So Chuck, imagine, if you will, for a minute, you have an app on your phone and the app stops, isn't functioning right. It's glitchy. So what's happened with that glitch is there's probably a couple of characters in all of those, all of that programming that's gotten out of whack. So imagine in programming, we can go through all that lines. We can go through all that line of code and we can find the error and we can fix the error. Well, this is kind of what the doctor's saying now, is being able to look at your genetic code and find the error and reprogram.
Well, this is an error just by you're born with these things and they're errors to begin with, or
bad luck.
Bad luck.
So these things, they happen. Maybe you're exposed to a toxin in the environment. Maybe there's radiation from space. Bad things happen every so often. You can get a mistake that just pops up.
Let me ask you something. It affects, let's bring it down to me. I had a four-way bypass at age 56. I'm the oldest living male on the paternal side of my family by 20 years. Sure. Everybody had just bad hearts, bad. Is that genetic? Is that
a big part of it? Could be genetic, especially if it's running in your family. So heart disease is complicated. It's not something like Huntington's disease or cystic fibrosis or sickle cell. Those are really genetic diseases. Those are directly caused by a single mistake. Heart disease is more complicated. Genes do influence heart disease, but environment and the lifestyle choices, the choices that you make, or are made for you, also play into it. So I'd say it's about half and half. So in your case, it sounds like you have probably some genes that are contributing to your heart disease. Maybe some of the things that you do also influence your risk of heart disease. But since it's running into your family, I suggest it suggests that, that genes are playing a role.
Right.
And what we could do with CRISPR is potentially do things to reverse that risk that's caused by your genes. So let me give you an example. So we all know that cholesterol is a big driver of heart disease, and you're probably on a medication to reduce your cholesterol levels if you've had bypass surgery.
I'm up to 13 medications a day.
Yeah, well, I believe it. And we give these medications because they help. They prevent the next heart attack, and they keep you healthy after having the first heart attack or having bypass surgery or having any problems with the heart.
I was very lucky. I didn't have a heart attack. They caught it before.
That's great. That's great. You're very fortunate that way. But you have to take all these medications, and that's pills every day. It's very inconvenient. Right. Those medications could have side effects. They can interfere with each other. It's a big deal. Now, what we can potentially do with CRISPR, and this is where it gets exciting, is that we can potentially go into your liver and turn off one or more of those cholesterol genes, those genes that actually cause your cholesterol to be higher, and permanently turn them off, which means your cholesterol levels would permanently come down and you'd be protected to some degree against heart disease for the rest of your life. And if you're taking that cholesterol lowering drug every day for the rest of your life, that's what you have to do right now.
Right.
You can potentially take that off the list with a CRISPR therapy, might be able to reproduce that effect with a single therapy, with a single shot, almost like a vaccination against heart
disease. We're down to 13.
So we can't get rid of all of them, not yet. But
so doctor, you're working on what we'll refer to for the audience's sake as a vaccine for heart disease, right?
Yeah.
It's not a vaccine in the real technical term of a vaccine.
Sure.
But it would be something that you would take prophylactically. You would take like an injection, like you would get a vaccine, correct?
That's right. You get it once and then it has a long lasting effect, potentially lifelong effect, just like a vaccination would protect you against some sort of infectious disease, like polio or something along those lines.
And how profound would this be on the population of America?
Well, so I think we're looking far in the future, but imagine if you had a good vaccine, if we're going to call it a vaccine, or at least a one-shot therapy that reduces the risk of heart disease, protects you from heart disease for the rest of your life. Imagine if you offered that to everybody. Everyone could choose, say they're 20 years old or 30 years old, long before they've gotten heart disease. In your case, potentially decades before you had to have bypass surgery, Chuck. Imagine that everyone was able to get this vaccination. You don't have to take it. You know, no one's going to force you to take it, I think, but you'd have the option. Let's say enough people in the population took this. Mm-hmm. It would reduce their risk of heart disease. It would put off any heart attacks that they were going to get. It would put off those heart attacks, delay it by decades, or maybe they don't have heart attacks at all. And across the whole population, you're talking about people living longer, healthier, it would improve life expectancy. That's what we're really talking about here.
Wow.
So like with every great technology, if I could switch gears on you here a little bit, Kieran, every great sure. technology has a good side and a bad side.
Absolutely.
We see the good side here. The good side is preventing things like heart attacks, and there's all kinds of diseases. And I'm going to assume that we could even get involved using CRISPR for things like Down syndrome and autism and things of that nature.
It's possible someday we'll be able to do that.
So, Chuck, imagine looking and saying that a fetus has Down syndrome and being able to deliver a therapy that would turn it off.
Yeah, that'd be unbelievable.
Yes, shut it off. What's the downside? What's the dark side? Every technology has a dark side. What's the dark side here?
Yeah, so I think there's several things to think about. The first is, in whom are you using this technology? So we've talked about adults with heart disease who've had bypass surgeries like yourself, Chuck, who have clear disease and are either suffering from it or have the potential to suffer from it. And they can freely consent to get a therapy. If I offer a vaccination against heart disease, you would have the ability to weigh the benefits, the risks, and make a rational decision and choose. You have that right. You have that ability. And the choice is ultimately up to you. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is that if we were to give you that vaccination, we would be turning off a cholesterol gene in your liver. We wouldn't be turning it off in your entire body, because we wouldn't really need to, and it wouldn't really be possible to do so. We'd only turn it off in your liver because the liver is where the cholesterol is made. And so it's very targeted just to where the problem is. And so there would be no chance of the effects of that vaccination affecting any future generations, children, grandchildren, and so forth. It's really limited to you and just you. Now, there is the possibility of using CRISPR, doing gene editing in embryos, all the way back to when an embryo is a single cell that's created by the fusion of a sperm cell from dad and an egg cell from mom. That is a single cell. And from that single cell, that single embryo, the whole human being ultimately arises after 9 months of pregnancy. And so it is possible to make edits, to use CRISPR, to make edits in that single cell. And then the person who arises from that cell, after that cell divides many, many, many times, makes the hundreds and millions and billions and all the cells that ultimately end up in a live-born human being, all of the cells would have the edits. And the problem there is that all of the cells in a person includes either that person's sperm cells, if they're male, or egg cells, if they're female. And the edits are in the cells too. So they could pass it on to their children, and those children could pass it on to their children. Now, you're talking about future generations, none of whom had any say in whether the editing should be done. It happened long before any of them were born.
Let me ask you a question here then. We're talking about gene editing at an embryonic state. Mm-hmm. Intelligence, one of the greatest markers, and again, we're getting into, you know, causation, you know, versus correlation.
Sure.
From a correlation standpoint, we know that the best thing you can do to have an intelligent kid is to have two intelligent parents.
I think that contributes some, but I think there are other things that are also important. Education, making sure that the environment is optimal, making sure that the kid is not exposed to chemicals or lead or things of that sort. A lot of factors come in.
Absolutely.
You know, I tell you what, I dated one of the prettiest girls in the world in high school. She had the ugliest parents I ever saw in my life. I don't know how they spawned this woman.
It's not all genetics.
It jumped a generation. But where I'm going with this is statistically. Okay, so statistically, we know that two smart parents are more likely to have a smart child. Now, yes, it could be that they value education more, so on and so forth. where I'm going with this is, are we going to get to a designer baby standpoint where people who have the money and the resources say, well, I want my child to be 6'5". I want my child to have 160 IQ. I want my child to have blue eyes and high cheekbones.
You know, it sounds like plastic surgery. Just go in and order what you want.
Yeah, the possibility is there. So you can kind of divide it into two categories. You can have medical uses of gene editing, and then you can have non-medical uses, what I would call enhancements, right? And so the possibility is there to do either type of change. And so medical uses would be parents who, for medical reasons, wouldn't be able to have a healthy biological child unless editing was done in the embryo. They're rare, but those cases happen. Or it could be parents who want to reduce their risk of a child having something bad in their lifetime, like Alzheimer's disease or breast cancer or heart disease. So you can imagine medical uses of the technology. Or on the flip side, you can imagine enhancements, and that could be cosmetic things. That could be eye color or hair color or something like that. Or it could be more substantial things like intelligence or athletic ability. Now, mind you, those are complicated things. And so it may not be so easy to make an intelligent baby or give a baby or a person, greatly enhanced athletic ability by changing genes. You might have to change hundreds of genes for that happen.
Right. When we look at anybody's gene sequence, outside of some profound genetic disease, most of us, when you look through our gene sequence, we have some winners and some losers. Would you agree with that?
I think that's fair.
So we look through and we say, oh, look at this. I have a gene that protects me from this and protects me from this, but I've got two genes over here, MTHFR, whatever the case is, and now I can't process folate. So you got some winners and losers.
I have no idea what an MTFCR or whatever you said is.
It's actually MTHFR, but we'll get into that later.
I don't know what that is. Everybody out there listening is going, oh, yeah, sure. What's
the doctor
that?
And I know what it is.
No, good. Well, keep it to yourselves.
So could somebody go in and say, I want to give my child all the positive genes? And I know that's not possible today, because if you could go in and wipe out the downside and switch, whether it's epigenetically or whatever, but if you could switch everybody to the best set of gene sequence, you could darn near come up with superhuman individuals.
I take your point, but here's the thing. So you mentioned winners and losers, but it's not quite that simple, because a single gene can be both a winner and a loser depending on the situation.
Absolutely.
Right? So let me give you a very pertinent example. There's a gene called CCR5. What those letters and numbers means, not important. What is important is that if you turn off this gene, and there are some people who are born with this gene naturally turned off, about 1% of Europeans, in fact. If you have this gene turned off, you are protected against HIV. That's the virus that causes AIDS.
Yep.
It's hard to get infected. It doesn't fully protect you, but it gives you a great measure of protection against HIV, which sounds like a great thing. Now, here's the problem. It turns out, you're protected against HIV, but you're more vulnerable to other viral infections, the most concerning one being flu. So it turns out that if you happen to get the flu and you have this gene turned off, you're actually much more likely to have a serious illness, much more likely to die. So they're trade-offs, right? It might be good in the context of HIV, of AIDS, but it's a loser when it comes to flu infection. And so then it becomes a balance between the good and the bad. And, the point is that there can be unintended consequences. You might go about flipping genes in an embryo because you want your kid to have, the best possible health, the best possible everything, but you might inadvertently being actually causing harm because you can't anticipate what that kid, what that eventually adult is going to face in their lifetime.
Now, how can governments misuse this?
Hang on just one second. I've got a question prior to that. I was going to ask that too. So you beat me to the point, but from 0 to 100%, how much do we know? How far down this road are we with this vaccination or whatever you call it, the genome adjustment?
It depends. So if you're talking about what we were speaking about earlier and what I work on, which is a heart attack vaccine, if you want to call it that, I'd say we're about 30% of the way there. We've tested it in animals. It works well. You can turn off the cholesterol genes, reduce cholesterol levels, but it's going to be a few years before we can actually test it in human beings. But it's on the horizon. In a few years, our hope is that we'll be able to do clinical trials and be able to take patients who have very bad heart disease and will die if they have another heart attack, for example, where we might actually test it in them and then prove that it's effective and prove that it's safe. And then at that point, be able to offer it to more people. So in that case, it's not all that far away. Now, if you're talking about taking an embryo and changing lots of genes and making that into, you know, super baby, like a super intelligent baby or super strong baby, I think, you know, we're maybe 1%, 2%, yeah, honestly, of the way there. It's just so complicated and we don't understand the genetics enough right now.
Things move at a pretty fast pace these days, though. So, you know, you could do this. Yeah,
it does. It's in science does accelerate, Chuck. And part of that big reason for acceleration is as we get more powerful and powerful computers, we have the ability to burn through calculations at a much quicker rate, especially as we move into stuff like quantum computers and AI now. So let's get back to the question of how can a bad government misuse this?
Yeah. So now you start to bring up, you know, classic science fiction tropes and things of that sort, right?
Well, not really. If you go back to the Nazis, they were into stuff.
Maybe
not like this, but into other things to make superhumans.
That's a very fair point. So you can imagine, a government wanting to use this sort of technology to make stronger people with the idea that they would serve as soldiers, right? Again, is that technically possible? Could it actually be done? Well, we're nowhere near that state right now. Will it ever be possible? I think we'll have to see. But you can imagine the government wanting to encourage or enforce certain traits in the population, or at least groups of people, and mandating that the technology be used in embryos, or potentially not in embryos, but in people. If you had ways of changing things in people after they were born.
Like make you more subservient?
Well, it's theoretically possible, right? Yeah. If you knew the right genes to tweak and it somehow affected personality, you know, technologically, it might be possible.
Mm-hmm. If you looked at genes like, I'll bring a gene up. What about like RS44680? That would be the, what's that called? The warrior gene.
I'm not familiar with that one, but probably one that affects muscle tone or the types of muscles or something like that.
RS4680, it's on the 22nd chromosome. What that gene does is if you have two, we'll say, val-val expressions on it, then you don't experience stress. If you have the two met-met expressions, then you are a genetic warrior. You're worried about everything.
Huh. Oh, warrior. I thought you said warrior.
Warrior. Yeah, it's actually called the warrior gene.
Interesting. Okay.
The warrior expression is actually what they look for in the Navy SEALs.
Huh. Okay.
These are people that will never have PTSD. These are people that can have bullets flying around their head and they'll just continue to move on.
Yeah. So you can imagine that gene being tweaked in with the idea that a government might want to create a group of people that would serve as soldiers, as Navy SEALs or whatnot. But again, what's often a winner in one situation can be a loser in another situation, right? There are reasons why we have fear. There are reasons why, you know, we shy away from certain situations. It's in the interest of self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And so, we've evolved that way that, you know, we respond to our environment in different ways, depending on the situation. And the genes, again, they're very complicated. And so what can be a winner in one situation can turn out to be a loser in another situation.
Hey, Chuck, can I interrupt the show for a minute?
Absolutely not.
All right. Well, I've already done it.
You have. Chuck, have your way with me. Go ahead.
I want to thank people. We just opened up our own Patreon page. Now, to remind people what's going on here.
Tell me what that is, because I'm not really familiar with it. Is it like standing on a corner with a tin cup or what?
But digitally.
Okay. Wow. I've come a long way in the world.
So what it is, Chuck, as I've said before, Media Matters and the left has been going after all of our advertisers.
Oh, I know. I know.
And they go after everybody's advertisers.
Right.
So we're not the only program doing this. The Rubin Report now does this. And what we've done is we've asked our listeners to
help.
We're
really asking them to support us monetarily, right? To send some money in so we can stay on the air and actually talk to people every week.
Exactly.
And again, how embarrassing to have to resort to that. I'm so sorry, folks, but I mean, I guess we have to depend on you to actually keep us on the air, because the left is just so strong about, they just pillar these advertisements.
They want us gone.
We're going to have to be doing Relief Factor or something pretty soon.
Well, the bottom line is, you know, here's what it amounts to. Some of our audience has already gone to Patreon. The way you do it, Chuck, is you go to bluntforcetruth.com.
Yeah.
You'll see a button there for, you know, contribute at Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
You open up an account at Patreon, and some people, we've got people that are, you know, giving $5 a month. We've got people giving $20 a month. God bless them. I am
That's
so
great.
Grateful
yeah,
for
no
that.
Kidding.
And I want people to understand, this money goes to the staff. It's not going to Chuck and I.
No, it's to keep the program on the air, because it's not inexpensive, and we require a certain amount of staff in order to do it.
Right. So it's only to pay for the staff and for the cost of putting the show out. But folks, if you want to support the show, if you want to keep the show on the air, I would ask you to join up with other people that are. Go to bluntforcetruth.com, look for the Patreon button, click on, it'll take a minute. And we would just, you know, be very grateful. And we love the people that are supporting us. We love you for doing it. And we love the people that are about to.
Absolutely. This is what I do in my old age.
All right, let's get back to the show. So tell us about your book. Now, you wrote a book about the world's first gene-edited babies.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about the book. And there's been some of this happening in China, right?
Yeah, so about a year ago, in fact, today turns out to be the one-year anniversary of the news breaking, not the birth of the gene-edited babies, but the world learning about these gene-edited babies. So they were born early last November or late October. The exact birthday is a little bit ambiguous. But there was a Chinese scientist who decided that he wanted to be the first in the world to make gene-edited babies, and he recruited parents who agreed to essentially have their unborn children experimented on. And his goal was to turn off this gene, CCR5, that I mentioned earlier. This is the gene that, when turned off, protects against HIV, against the virus that causes AIDS. And so he went ahead and did it. He didn't really ask for permission from anyone in any meaningful way. He was very secretive about it. It happened, you know, without any transparency, without any real oversight.
And well, they are communists, you know.
Well, he just went ahead and did it. And I'm not, you know, it's unclear how much the government was involved and how much he just self-funded the work. He turns out he's a fairly wealthy, or he was a fairly wealthy man, because he had started several companies. And so it's possible that he just decided, I want to do it. I want to be the first. I want to make history. I want to win the Nobel Prize, because that's really what he was thinking in his mind, that this was going to be a big scientific achievement. And he actually had embryos from these volunteer parents. And he attempted to use CRISPR to turn off this gene, with the idea that the kids would then, after they were born, would be protected from HIV, which may sound like a good thing. But here's the problem. He didn't really know what he was doing. And so the potential bad consequences of something like CRISPR is, you don't just turn off the gene or make a change in a gene that you want to change. You might accidentally affect other genes. And so you might turn off other genes, you might change other genes. If you're not carefully controlling the use of this technology, if you're not really being responsible and making sure that you know exactly what you're doing, there can actually be pretty bad unintended consequences, genetic damage, if you will. And it's very clear from what we've learned about these embryos, two embryos in particular that ended up becoming twin girls after a pregnancy. And those are the twins that, as I said, were born late October, early November last year. These are the first gene edited babies. And the problem is that the gene editing was very sloppy, very messy. There were some changes to the CCR5 gene, but it's not clear whether it was enough to make these kids protected against HIV. They may still be as vulnerable as anybody else, but they also have other genetic changes that might actually have serious health consequences and might increase their risk of cancer, heart disease. And because these edits are in their bodies, they can potentially pass these edits to their children. And the problem is we don't know. This is an entirely unknown. This is, you know, a new frontier.
This sounds like Dr. Moreau, the Island of Dr. Moreau stuff.
I mean, if you want to go, you know, we were talking about, you know, old science fiction tropes. This guy was a rogue scientist who was doing genetic experimentation on babies. You know, no two things about it. That's what this was. I mean,
it's really happening.
Yeah, and it's really happening. It caused a big uproar, certainly in the biomedical community. But I think it also got a fair amount of attention in the lay press, all the major newspapers. I think many people heard about this. And it happened. And so you know, we've crossed that line. We've crossed that threshold, you know, for better or for worse. Started gene editing embryos. It's caused a lot of fuss. There are a lot of calls for a ban or a moratorium or international regulations to prevent this thing from happening in the way that it did, right? This guy decided, I'm just going to do it. I don't need anyone looking over my shoulder. I'm just going to, you know, forge ahead and start experimenting. That's not the way things are done, right? Whenever we test a drug in patients, we have to go through a long process, test the drug in animals, then apply to the Food and Drug Administration for approval to do a clinical trial, to do it safely. And you often have to submit hundreds or thousands of pages of documentation that you know what you're doing and that you tested it properly and that you can be reasonably sure that it's safe before you're allowed to actually put it in a human being. He did none of that. He just went ahead.
Well, earlier studies on this was like Dolly the sheep, right?
Yeah.
And what happened with Dolly the sheep?
So Dolly, as I understand it, lived to a ripe old age, had little dollies, or, you know, had babies of her own. And I think that
what is a ripe old age for a sheep?
I actually don't know. 10 years? I'm making,
I don't know.
It depends if the sheep lives in Arkansas or not. Right. But other than
good question. But so it's, you know, gene editing has been done in animals. And what we know is that, you know, it can work well, but it can also cause problems.
Did Dolly have problems from that?
There's some discussion about whether her health was not as good because she had undergone, in her case, it was cloning. There have been experiments showing that cloned animals do seem to be less healthy than the parents from whom they were cloned. You know, again, it's hard because it's not like we're cloning thousands and thousands of animals. Typically, we're talking about, you know, a few animals that have been cloned and that we study, and it's hard to draw any big conclusions from just a few animals. But there is that safety concern, and gene editing has been done in lots of different types of animals now, and sometimes it turns out fine, and often there are unexpected problems. And
how far are we away from being able to clone a human?
Now we had someone who, I'm sorry, say that again, clone a human?
How far are we away from being able to clone a human?
Well, it's a little bit different from gene editing because there you're not actually changing any genes. You're just taking somebody's genetic information from one of their cells and then putting it into an embryo. So it's kind of a, you know, replacing a whole set of DNA with DNA from another person. So it's not editing per se, but how far are we away? Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, it was about 14 years ago now. 15 years ago now.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, there was a cult that announced that they had actually successfully cloned a human baby and actually made world headlines and, you know, a lot of, you know, excitement, negative excitement, I should say, about that, and a lot of concern. I mean, it turned out to be a big hoax. And what we have learned since then is that it's actually really, really, really hard to do that sort of cloning. And a monkey, which is sort of the closest we have to a human being in, you know, when we're talking about different species. The monkey was cloned for the first time just last year. And it turned out to be very, very hard to do it. You had to go through a whole complicated procedure. It turned out to be much harder than scientists anticipated. So all of this is to say that if you were going to clone a human being, it would not be easy. I don't think we're close. I think it would be many years away. I think it would actually be far easier to edit human beings. And the reason I say that is because it's already been done as of last year, right? You have these babies who were born. It wasn't done well. It was done in a very haphazard fashion, and they might suffer health consequences from it, but it was done.
So in the arms race for CRISPR, because again, where we really see the advantage with CRISPR is being able to go after disease states that have a genetic base to them. How are we as the United States doing in that race as opposed to other countries? And how are we doing in as much as are we making the type of investments into these type of sciences that we should be?
Absolutely. So if you're talking about living people, if you're talking about adults or potentially children who have bad disease and for whom CRISPR is intended as a treatment, we're doing very well there. So we are running quite a few, and when I say we, I mean companies in the United States or institutions like my university, University of Pennsylvania, are now running clinical trials, testing CRISPR therapies in patients with different diseases, ranging from cancer to sickle cell disease to rare liver disorders, to a genetic form of blindness, and you know, I'm hoping in a few years, heart disease. So that's underway, and so in the United States, we've made a lot of progress. And as I mentioned earlier, there are actually those two patients with the blood disorders who look like they might actually be cured. So I would say we're doing very well. We're ahead of other countries in this respect. And a lot of that has to do with our very robust scientific infrastructure, the research funding from the government, from the National Institutes of Health, and honestly, our capitalist system, that allows for startup companies to get substantial amounts of venture capital funding and be able to take on projects like this and take something like CRISPR that just appeared on the scene 6 years ago and actually turn into therapies that are now being tested in patients.
So it sounds like most of this is happening in the private sector.
That's right. Most of it is.
So again, Chuck, this gets back to when we look at socialism versus capitalism. Capitalism is what's really providing for the public advancement.
Yeah.
It's still individual money. It's still business that's making this happen. And I'm sure the government has some hand in this, but it's much.
They don't now, they will eventually.
Yeah, well, the government plays an important role because it allows things like CRISPR to be discovered. If you don't have the tools, if you don't have the technology to start with, then you know none of the cures can happen. But then there's a point at which it transitions from the basic research that's funded by the government, and then startup companies or existing companies take advantage of the results of that research and turn it into therapies. And the reason it requires companies is because it's really expensive. It takes hundreds of millions of dollars to actually take something from, you know, the very beginning to all the way to actually having a cure or a treatment that's gone through clinical trials, shown to be effective, shown to be safe, and then can be offered to the people.
And this is a good reason why, when you think about the cost of therapies, Chuck, when you think of hundreds of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars being spent, this is why drug companies, and I'm not defending drug companies, but this is why sometimes early treatments are so expensive. Because
the research, the amount of research, how much it costs. I mean, yeah, to develop these, you know.
Needs to be recovered.
Drugs, whatever they are.
You have to recover that investment.
Right. You know, I'm surprised, and maybe you can or can't answer this, but I'm surprised that we have so many billionaires in this country, people who have extreme wealth. The left is always talking about this. And I wonder why they don't really invest in this kind of stuff when they're talking about philanthropy and that kind of thing.
They really are.
It would seem to me like that would be a real open opportunity for so many of these people to be involved in new projects, new science, new things. Instead of perhaps government, the private enterprise, individuals like Jeff Bezos, people like that who have, you know, $100 million or $100 billion. Do they get involved in this stuff? I mean, is this kind of thing that they would be involved in or not?
I'm glad you asked that. So it turns out that some of my own research, so I have a laboratory at University of Pennsylvania, and I do get quite a bit of funding from the government. But government, the kind of funding that comes from the government tends not to be focused on really cutting edge, really kind of out there, pushing the edge of the envelope type of research. It tends to be lower risk type of research. And so for some of my crazier ideas, for example, a heart attack vaccination, it hasn't been so easy to get funding from the government. They kind of like to want to see it proven before they're willing to fund
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the fortunate position of having a wealthy individual, actually a family, who you know, saw the value of the work that I was doing and were willing to give a substantial donation, a philanthropic contribution to my university to fund my work as well as the work of several other individuals in my university. And that is
so many of these universities have billions and billions of dollars that, universities, I don't know whether all of them are, but universities are known to be probably the most wealthy places on earth. I mean, good Lord, UT here in Austin, Harvard, just billions of dollars. They just, I don't know what they do with it besides invest it.
Yeah. Endowments.
Endowments. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a complicated question, a little bit above my pay grade. I'm not a university administrator, but they have their endowments and they're not going to spend it all at once, right? They want to preserve most of that money so it can continue to have a return on the investment. And then they use the returns each year to fund various, you know, initiatives at the university, to fund financial aid, to hire new faculty members, a whole variety of different uses. And so it's not like, you know, they're just sitting on the money and letting it totally accumulate. They do have to spend some amount of that money on things that further the mission of the university, which is education and research.
And Chuck, back to your question, as far as billionaires, I can tell you that like the guys at Google, they have, what is their anti-aging group? Is that Calico?
That's Calico. Yep.
Calico. They are investing heavily in life extension and anti-aging. Bezos has invested heavily in it. Richard Branson has invested heavily in it. So there is a lot of tremendous work on the future of healthcare that is being funded by the very people that some of our friends on the Democratic side are trying to vilify right now.
Well, let me ask you, I understand that. Let me ask you this. And this is a little off subject, I guess, but we're still talking about health. Cancer has been around forever. I mean, as far as I know, it's always been part of the problem with human beings, as well as heart attacks and things like that. But they're always asking for money and always doing research. Why is it that cancer is just so incredibly difficult to cure?
It's a very wily foe. So heart disease, you know, I don't want to oversimplify it, but in a sense, it's kind of like a plumbing problem. You have these blockages in your artery, plaques. These plaques can break, they can rupture, they can cause big blood clots to form. That's what causes heart attack, right? So it's simple in the sense that if you can figure out how to cure heart disease once, you're done, right? Because it's more of a mechanical issue. Cancer is very different. So the problem with cancer, and the same is true, by the way, of bacterial infections or viral infections.
Is it because it mutates?
They mutate, yeah. And so you can come up with a treatment that works really well. It might eliminate 99.9% of those cancer cells, but there might be a few cells that just have mutated and find a way to get around your treatment. And then once, you know, they escape, they grow. That's what cancer cells do. That's what, you know, bacteria do. They grow and then, you know, it's almost like starting over. And then before you know it, the cancer has come back or the bacterial infection has come back. And so it's going to be an evolutionary arms race, right? We come up with new cancer drugs, we come up with new antibiotics. And then even if just a few, you know, cells in a cancer in a person or a few bacteria manage to mutate around those drugs or those treatments, they'll come flaring right back. And then you got to either go to the next drug or treatment, hope that there is one, or, you know, cross your fingers and hope that your body can fight it off, which unfortunately often doesn't happen.
So Kieran, what will if our audience goes out and picks up your book, and the book again is called The CRISPR Generation, The Story of the World's First Gene Edited Babies. What are they going to learn in the book? What are they going to get out of it?
So what they're going to learn is they're both the good and the bad. So they'll get a sense of, first and foremost, what gene editing is, how it works, and the history behind it, all the hard work that had to go into actually creating this technology that we're now finally using for the benefit of patients. So that's a big part of it. And then focusing on the good, the applications that will help patients with bad diseases and be able to tackle diseases like cancer and sickle cell and heart disease. But there's also the bad, and that is irresponsible use of the technology in, for example, embryos to make gene-edited babies before we're really in a position to be able to do so safely and responsibly. And so, you know, it focuses on these two twin girls that were born last year as a result of this Chinese scientist's, you know, rogue clinical trial, if you want to call it that.
I guess there could be international laws or whatever against this kind of experimentation, right?
Yeah, well, there's a big discussion right now. And so the book provides some of the background, I think, that's necessary to have a meaningful discussion. You know, what went wrong? There were scientific problems. The editing was very messy. There were ethical problems. You know, it was done without any oversight. A whole bunch of other ethical problems that are, you know, I could talk for hours and we still wouldn't get through. But you're exactly right. So we're in a position now, a year later, to really try to figure out how do we prevent this from happening.
Well, there's got to be a whole regulatory board put together, I guess, to just address this alone.
Yeah. So in fact,
like there, most there, other things.
Yeah. So there are two ongoing efforts.
Ethical board.
Whatever. Yeah. Well, the problem is there's no international ethical board that has the force of law. Right. It can't force any countries
here,
to do anything.
You know,
you could try, but then, you know, can you force other countries to adopt it? I mean, that's the problem,
exactly.
Right? So what's happening now is the World Health Organization on the one hand, and the United States, the National Academy of Medicine, the National Academy of Science, on the other hand, they've created these committees or commissions with broad international representation. So members from different countries and different backgrounds, physicians, scientists, ethicists, regulators, and so forth. And these two commissions or committees are working towards devising a regulatory framework that will hopefully better regulate this technology, make sure that it's used responsibly and not in a very irresponsible, dangerous way. Now, they'll report out next year, probably late next year, with their recommendations. The problem is neither of these groups will have the force of law. They can't make anybody do anything. They can't make governments of countries do anything. What they can do is they can advise, they can make suggestions, they can, you know, cajole and try to persuade. And hopefully what will happen is many countries will take those recommendations seriously and then pass laws and regulations that are consistent with those recommendations.
Well, everybody, the book is called The CRISPR Generation. It is by Dr. Kiran Musunuru. Kiran, thanks for being with us here on Blunt Force Truth.
And thank
folks,
you, Doctor.
If you want to learn more about that, go to the show notes at bluntforcetruth.com. Look for this episode. We'll have links to the doctor's work and where you'll be able to find the book.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We really appreciate having you on. And I hope you all learned something. I did from our show today. And we'll see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.